Hello, and welcome to our accredited presentation entitled Strategies for Improving Patient Outcomes in Myelofibrosis. Today's program is provided by Medicom Worldwide Incorporated and is supported by educational grants from Constellation Pharmaceuticals Incorporated, Amorphosys Company, CTI BioPharma Corp, Incyte Corporation, and Karyopharm Therapeutics Incorporated. It is now my pleasure to turn this webcast over to Dr. Jean Palmer, Associate Professor, Section Head of Hematology, Director of Blood and Marrow Transplant Program at the Mayo Clinic in Phoenix, Arizona. Dr. Palmer, the floor is now yours.
All right, excellent. Thank you very much for having me. Hopefully today we will learn a little bit more about myelofibrosis. So the learning objectives today is first to outline strategies for effectively and accurately diagnosing myelofibrosis, and also how to stratify myelofibrosis patients according to risk. We want to correlate safety and efficacy data for the new and emerging therapies in myelofibrosis with patient types and clinical scenarios that are most appropriate. We want to identify treatment emergent adverse events associated with these therapeutic options and outline some proactive clinical strategies for minimizing or mitigating these adverse events when they develop. And finally, how do we identify strategies for developing optimized tailored treatment plans for individuals with myelofibrosis? These are my disclosures. So let's start with talking about myeloproliferative neoplasms and how myelofibrosis fits into this category. So myeloproliferative neoplasms include things like polycythemia vera, essential thrombocythemia, early primary myelofibrosis, or prefibrotic myelofibrosis. In these diseases, we typically are worried about vascular events, symptom management, and generally speaking, people may have these for a number of years before they develop myelofibrosis, and a number of patients will have these diseases and not progress to myelofibrosis. Only about 10 to 15% of patients with PV or ET present to overt myelofibrosis or post-ET or PV myelofibrosis. Now, in the primary myelofibrosis, it got trickier in 2016 because they added this prefibrotic myelofibrosis, which largely behaves a little bit more like essential thrombocythemia. Usually these patients have high platelets, but there are a couple other abnormalities that would suggest it's more of a prefibrotic myelofibrosis than a straight ET. Nonetheless, if they have a prefibrotic myelofibrosis, they generally are treated more like ET. What we're going to focus on today is overt primary myelofibrosis and post-ET PV myelofibrosis. This can be characterized by progressive constitutional symptoms, progressive organomegaly or extramedullary hematopoiesis, and progressive cytopenias. Patients who have this disease have a higher risk of transformation to leukemia and can have premature death. And the time frame in which this happens can vary substantially. 3 to 5 years is most common, probably because when people are diagnosed, but there are a number of patients, especially if they have good prognostic features, that can go 10, 20 years with this disease. So case-based presentations are always kind of a good way to get your mind in the right place. So we're going to talk about this patient, Joan, a 57-year-old female. She was found to have mild anemia, platelets of 512. And in her peripheral blood, she was found to have a JAK2 mutation. She has no constitutional symptoms. She feels well. She has a workup done to evaluate this, and iron studies are normal, so she gets a bone marrow biopsy. This is what her bone marrow biopsy looks like. There's a couple features here that are worth noting. First of all, when you look at the megakaryocytes, I don't know if you can see my pointer here, but I'm pointing to kind of those large amorphous pink-looking cells with the purple nuclei in it. And those are very atypical. And as you can see, they're clustering. And you can see that best in the B frame there. In the C frame, you see reticulin staining. And this basically looks for evidence of fibrosis. And you can see a fair amount of sort of intersecting lines. It almost looks like a very disorganized set of country roads. But that is the fibrosis that is present. So when we look at the diagnostic criteria of myelofibrosis, there are three major criteria and five minor criteria. So the major criteria, you know, you want to see collagen or reticulin or collagen fibrosis of grade 2 to 3. Usually that's on a scale of 0 to 3. They can't meet any, they don't meet criteria for any other disorders. So sometimes patients with myelodysplastic syndrome can have fibrosis. Sometimes patients with CML can actually have fibrosis. So just having the fibrosis by itself does not necessarily mean you have a diagnosis of primary myelofibrosis. Even in some cases, you can have reactive fibrosis in the marrow from autoimmune diseases or other malignancies. And the other diagnostic criteria is presence of JAK2, calreticulin, or MPL, all three of which are driver mutations. And in the absence of mutations, it's always good to see another clonal marker. Sometimes you will not see any of that, and then you want to make sure you're not dealing with a reactive myelofibrosis. So the minor criteria, you want to make sure the anemia is not attributed to a comorbid condition, but anemia is one of the factors that can be a minor criteria. Leukocytosis of greater than 11, palpable splenomegaly, LDH increased to above the upper limit of normal, and leukoerythroblastosis, meaning that you see all sorts of cells that should not normally only live in the bone marrow showing up in the peripheral blood. And the diagnosis requires meeting all three major criteria and at least two minor criteria confirmed in two consecutive determinations. And when you'll say, well, geez, what about people who don't have driver mutations? If they don't have a driver mutation or another clonal marker, as long as you really feel this is not reactive fibrosis in the marrow, then they would meet that major criteria. That being said, if you don't find any of these mutations, you probably want to really make sure you've done due diligence to rule out other possibilities that could contribute to fibrosis. So when we think about how we work these patients up, they get a bone marrow biopsy with trichrome and reticulin stain. Cytogenetics. Now, many of these patients will have dry taps. Because they have so much scar tissue, you're unable to pull out the marrow. So if the bone marrow is inaspirable, you can do FISH on peripheral blood and karyotype. After all, many of the cells in the peripheral blood are actually marrow cells that, because they're growing in the spleen, are really pop out into the peripheral blood a lot easier. And then the molecular testing for JAK2. Now, 50% of people who have primary myelofibrosis or any primary myelofibrosis will have a JAK2V617F mutation. If that is negative, you can look for CALR and MPL. If somebody you think may have had PV preceding this, there is a JAK2 mutation. It's on exon 12. It's not the same as the V617F mutation. And then there are next generation sequencing panels, which look for all sorts of other genes like the ASXL1, IDH mutations, et cetera. So in our patient, she has normal cytogenetics. She has a JAK2 mutation, and next-gen sequencing shows a DNMT3A mutation. There's no increase in blasts in her marrow, and in her peripheral blood, she has less than 1% peripheral blasts. So when this patient's sitting in the office, there's going to be a couple things that should be going through your mind. First of all, she's 57 and otherwise in good health. So is this patient a transplant candidate? Even if she's not ready for transplant at the given time, it is always important to have this consideration because it sort of helps get them to see a transplanter and at least start thinking of that. Because even if they don't need it at that time, having that knowledge can be very helpful for patients in terms of planning. And do they desire a transplant? That should be a question answered after they've met a transplanter. And what is the risk? Because the risk of their disease largely factors into if they are going to be needing a transplant. You want to look at their symptoms. And then do they have spleen-related symptoms, such as getting full when they eat, having abdominal discomfort, or constitutional symptoms, such as fatigue, night sweats, and weight loss? And finally, do they have cytopenias? So there's been a lot of risk models that have been developed for myelofibrosis, probably too many. And when we look at this, the IPSS is sort of the one that was developed initially, and it's gotten kind of obsolete. The DIPSS, or the Dynamic International Prognostic Scoring System, is similar to the IPSS, but gives more weight to the anemia with a hemoglobin of less than 10. The DIPSS Plus also takes into account low platelets, the need for red blood cell transfusions, and unfavorable karyotype. So how are these scores generated? The DIPSS is a pretty easy score to generate because you basically add up these points. You can do it in your head in clinic once you've done it enough times. And then when you add on and then to get to the DIPSS Plus, You take the low, intermediate two, or high risk, which you can see there, for the DIPSS, and then you add in extra factors that gives you a number. You add in the extra factors such as adverse karyotype, platelets, or red blood cell transfusions, and ultimately then you get to their DIPSS plus risk. Now, there's median survivals given here. I think it's really, really important to remember that these scoring systems were developed prior to the approval of ruxolitinib, which is a very commonly used medication in myelofibrosis, and may change survival. So when talking to a patient, I'm always reluctant to give them survival times per se, because we've over the last 10, 15 years, we've really changed our approach to myelofibrosis and improved our treatment. So people are living longer with it. So where these may provide a good set of guardrails to sort of understand a person's risk and are very helpful when thinking about how we define the risk when thinking of transplant, be very cautious in interpreting the survival times. So what are the non-driver mutations? These are things that we look at that are mutations aside from the JAK2, CALR, or MPL. Those are felt to be driver mutations, and they really help develop the disease. Obviously, they're not the sole thing, because somebody can have PV, ET, or myelofibrosis and have a JAK2 mutation, or have the CALR and MPL and have either ET or primary myelofibrosis. So, but these extra non-driver mutations, there's a whole slew. I mean, every panel has a different number of mutations ranging from 40 to, 400. But there's a couple genes that seem to have come to be prognostically important. And that includes some of these genes in this yellow box, that primary myelofibrosis, so the SRSF2, ASXL1, IDH, 1 and 2, EZH2, TP53, which is fairly uncommon, U2AF1, and CBL. And so to account for these, they came up with the MIP70 and MIP70+. Now, this is actually a calculator you can go online. That is good, because then you can type in all their clinical factors and come up with what their risk score is. And then based on factors, now, one of the things to keep in mind is that this score is heavily driven by mutations. So if somebody has one or two high-risk mutations, it automatically puts them up into a higher risk category. Nonetheless, this does provide another set of guidelines that may help us determine if we think their disease is going to be more indolent or more aggressive. And finally, if they have secondary myelofibrosis, all of these scores I just talked about are actually only validated in primary myelofibrosis. So if somebody has secondary myelofibrosis, you can look at the MySix score. This is also a calculator online, and that's actually how I do it all the time, because it's a normogram. So you take into account some clinical and laboratory features, and then you plot this on a normogram based on age, and that gives you what your risk is. So, for example, in a patient who's 64, who has a hemoglobin of less than 11, platelets of less than 150, and has a CALR unmutated genotype, meaning they have either a JAK2 or MPL, they're 64, they would be considered intermediate two risk. And this breaks it down nicely to different survival times. Now, this was developed in 2017. So this was published after the, availability of ruxolitinib. But one of the groups that contributed to this, or a lot of this came from Europe. And in Europe, they actually had ruxolitinib available to them at a later date. It was approved in the United States first. So many of these patients also were not exposed to ruxolitinib. So taking these actual median survival times, you have to do with caution. So what is our treatment? How do we look at these patients? So, we have this 57-year-old. She has no symptoms, very mild cytopenias, and actually has thrombocytosis. Do we need to treat her? So she would be considered low risk, based on the fact that she doesn't have a very, white blood cell count greater than 25,000. She doesn't have a lot of blasts in her peripheral blood. She doesn't have anemia. So she would actually be considered low risk. And she's asymptomatic. She doesn't have spleen-related symptoms, doesn't have constitutional symptoms. So in this case, a lot of times you can watch and wait. If she had some fatigue, or if she had any constitutional symptoms, or had high white blood cell count, she might be intermediate one. And even in that case, if somebody comes in and doesn't have symptoms or spleen enlargement, I'm very, very reluctant to treat them. Now, if they have spleen enlargement, but they're not particularly bothered by it and have no symptoms, then it gets into a little bit more gray area of whether they should be treated or not. Now, if patients are intermediate to or high risk, even in that setting, you have to use ruxolitinib with caution, just because they have, even just because they have a JAK2 mutation, if they aren't having spleen-related symptoms and constitutional symptoms, ruxolitinib doesn't really provide a lot of benefit, and in fact, can actually worsen anemia. So when we take these patients, I think the most important thing when saying, what am I going to do for you today, really relies on a good assessment of the spleen and symptoms. So this, let's change this presentation a little bit. So this patient was found to have mild anemia of 10.5 or platelets of 512, peripheral blood showed JAK2 mutation, but she reports significant night sweats, you know, low-grade temperatures, weight loss, early satiety, and fatigue. She has a similar, everything else looks about the same. So in this patient, because she has these additional symptoms with this, even though she actually would probably fall into the same risk category, because she's so symptomatic, this would be a patient I would consider for ruxolitinib or some type of JAK inhibitor therapy. So let's talk about these JAK inhibitor therapies and how we use them. So ruxolitinib was the first approved. It was approved in 2011, after the COMFORT 1 and COMFORT 2 studies were published. COMFORT 1 took place in the United States, and it was ruxolitinib versus placebo. So it was a blinded study. This study looked at a spleen volume reduction of 35% and then reduction in the total symptom score, which is a set of questions you ask that kind of judge symptoms. And you want to see that reduced by 50%. Now, these were somewhat arbitrarily chosen. We thought, I think at the time it was felt that 35% spleen volume reduction likely represented something that would make somebody feel better. And the total symptom score of 50%, again, was sort of a number that was arbitrarily chosen for the purposes of the study. This has lasted for a long time and is an important thing to keep in mind. So what they looked at, again, the spleen volume reduction and total symptom score. I will also point out, this is really novel. This is probably one of the first studies that actually used patient-reported outcomes as a way of determining therapeutic success. So in this summary, when we look at the COMFORT 1 study, the spleen volume reduction of 35% was achieved in about 42% of patients receiving ruxolitinib and only 0.7 of those receiving placebo. And in the COMFORT 2 study, which was an open-label study using ruxolitinib versus best available therapy, 28% of patients who were in the ruxolitinib arm versus 0% in the best available therapy arm achieved that spleen volume reduction endpoint. Now, the biggest side effects that were seen were things like thrombocytopenia and anemia, and this was generally reversible or managed with dose reduction or temporarily withholding the drug. This is just a picture of, this is for COMFORT 1. You'll see these are waterfall plots. This is for spleen volume reduction. So as you see, the lower it goes, the more spleen volume, the more the spleen was reduced. And so you'll see that the 35% reduction, very few people had it in the placebo arm, and quite a few more patients had it in the ruxolitinib arm. And it's important to note that virtually all these patients, but a few, had some reduction in their spleen size. And total symptom score is not quite as clear cut. And I think one of the big questions is, you know, total symptom score takes into account a lot of things, and some of these factors that it takes into account, like early satiety and fatigue and night sweats, may have other causes. And so I don't think you see as much of a dramatic benefit, but you definitely clearly see a benefit. Now, COMFORT 2, they actually did not look at the total symptom score. They only looked at the spleen. And here you see that 28% who had spleen volume reduction. Now, one of the things people were asking, well, geez, what does this do for overall survival? Because that really is an important endpoint to patients. And, you know, because everyone was allowed to cross over, well, for COMFORT 1, they were allowed to cross over at 6 months had they not had a response. COMFORT 2, they actually looked at 48 weeks was the primary endpoint. And the patient had to progress to switch over. So the COMFORT 2 data was much more, I think, appropriate for looking at survival advantage. And what they did, because patients still were allowed to cross over when they progressed, and obviously without therapy or with just the best available therapy, which wasn't that helpful, many of them did progress. What they did was they tried to say, does this improve overall survival? And they used this statistical method called rank-preserving structural failure time, which ultimately is a method of trying to determine survival when you have crossovers that's allowed, that takes into account different time points and seeing what was the response at this and sort of predicting what would have happened. this is a very well validated. It's been used in many settings, this test. So I do think that it helps survival. Indeed, the data did show that survival was improved in patients who got ruxolitinib. So there's a couple of things that we have learned. Now, this is all sort of post hoc analysis to try to understand what things predict survival. So first of all, if the spleen shrinks in somebody who's on ruxolitinib, they will likely live longer. As you see here, if they have a greater than 50% spleen volume reduction, that's that top dark blue line, they actually had a much better survival than if they had less than 25% spleen volume reduction. This is in a pretty small population and had a great p-value. So I think that that definitely helps. Now, it's important to note the spleen volume reduction is likely a surrogate. If you take somebody's spleen out, you're not going to see that same survival advantage. So the spleen volume reduction, I think, is a surrogate for the JAK2 working well in many things in the body, including all the inflammation and other aspects of the disease. Now, one thing that people would ask is, well, geez, you just showed me how important anemia is to figuring out prognosis, but we know that ruxolitinib makes people anemic. So how do we take that into account? They actually went and looked at this and said, well, geez, if we take somebody and we've given them ruxolitinib and their hemoglobin drops, does that have the same implication as somebody who's not on ruxolitinib and hemoglobin drops? And the answer is that a drop from ruxolitinib likely does not have the same prognostic implication as somebody who has anemia without being on ruxolitinib. So when somebody's hemoglobin drops, it's not, now they're higher risk. This is terrible. It's, okay, well, it's probably because of the drug. It's probably not necessarily a metric of their underlying disease. Now, everyone's hemoglobin drops when you start ruxolitinib. Everyone's. It usually comes back up after a few months. So it's all about being patient and reassuring the patient that this does not reflect their disease going crazy. Another JAK2 inhibitor that was studied maybe a few years after ruxolitinib was fedratinib. This was studied in the Jakarta studies. The initial Jakarta study actually started before ruxolitinib was approved. So this was placebo and then two different doses of fedratinib. Week 24, they looked at the response based on splenomegaly. And then the patient was continued on fedratinib or not. The baseline characteristics of the study showed that they were all very similar, and the placebo and the two arms that had different doses of fedratinib. And when you looked at the spleen volume reduction and total symptom score reduction, you saw fairly consistent, in patients who got fedratinib, they had 36 to 40% achieved the 35% spleen volume reduction. And in patients who got the fedratinib, you saw a much better reduction or improvement in the symptom score. Now, with fedratinib, you see the similar hematologic side effects, thrombocytopenia, anemia, and neutropenia. But there's a notable difference in the non-hematologic adverse reactions. And that's diarrhea, vomiting, and nausea are much, much more common. So it's really, really important to counsel patients on this if they're going to start on fedratinib. Now, as many of these studies have unfortunately, you'll see with the JAK inhibitors following ruxolitinib, they all had a bumpy road to getting to be approved. And what happened with fedratinib was that a number of patients were found to have Wernicke's encephalopathy. So the FDA put the drug on clinical hold in November of 2013. And even though after very careful review of these patients, only probably one of them actually had Wernicke's encephalopathy. And this was thought to be more related to inadequate nutrition rather than a drug effect. They found that many of these cases that were thought to be Wernicke's actually probably weren't. Nonetheless, it's always important. There is some biologic basis for this. There's a very similar structure in thymine and fedratinib that you can see in red. And so it's important to check thymine when starting fedratinib. And if the patient experiences any neurologic symptoms, hold the fedratinib and give IV thymine. And somebody who is originally thymine deficient, replace that before starting the fedratinib. So Jakarta, when they did do some of the testing afterwards, even taking into account censorship, it did appear to improve progression-free survival in these patients. Understanding that these data you have to take with a grain of salt because the drug was held in the middle of clinical studies. So the patient was treated with ruxolitinib, had an excellent response. I think there's a key thing to remember. Number one, JAK inhibitors are a great drug, great as first-line therapy for patients with increased spleen size and symptom burden. If they do not have that, you don't necessarily need to use it. The other thing that's important to remember about JAK inhibitors is this is not something that beneficially works on the JAK2 mutation. What the JAK inhibitors do is they reduce inflammation because the JAK pathway is really involved in inflammation as well. And that reduction in inflammation is what gives us the benefit of the drug, not direct inhibition of JAK2. So if somebody has a calreticulin mutation or an MPL mutation, they still may benefit from Jakafi. You have to be careful of cytopenias because patients will always develop some mild cytopenias when you start the drug. Reassure them, and they do generally balance out after a few months of treatment. All right, so going on to our next case. John, he's a 69-year-old gentleman. He presented with pancytopenia and was referred for evaluation. His hemoglobin was 8.6, his platelets were 70, white blood cell count of 2.4, neutrophils of 1.4. He had no peripheral blasts. He has noted some left upper quadrant pain and early satiety, as well as night sweats. Bone marrow biopsy shows atypical megakaryocytes and 2 to 3 out of 3 plus fibrosis, no increase in blast. He has normal cytogenetics, and He had none of these mutations. He didn't have the JAK2 CALR MPL. He did have the ASXL1 and IDH2 mutation. We probably need. So when we look at his risk assessment, he really only gets risk based for the DIP score based on his age and his hemoglobin. He gets his DIPS plus score. He's still intermediate too, but he does, the thrombocytopenia adds to that. And for the MIP 70, he's high risk because he does not have a driver mutation and he has two high risk molecular mutations, being the ASXL1 and the IDH2, and the lack of the JAK2 CALR MIPL, which are driver mutations. Patient is offered a transplant consultation and declines. So as we've learned more about myelofibrosis, we've kind of been able to divide it a little bit. And it's a very sensical division. And it's one of the phenotypic divisions we can make is proliferative myelofibrosis and cytopenic myelofibrosis. Proliferative overall is generally a better one to have. It has a lower risk of progression to AML as compared to cytopenic myelofibrosis. It's more often secondary myelofibrosis. In the mutational landscape, there's a lot of the patients with proliferative myelofibrosis have JAK2 positivity, and they have a much lower percentage of somatic mutations. And variability in cytopenic myelofibrosis, they're more likely to be triple negative and to have a higher risk mutations. The JAK2 allele burden may differ between the two, although it's unclear that that has a significant prognostic implication. And finally, when patients with proliferative myelofibrosis often present with higher blood counts, pronounced splenomegaly and symptoms, whereas patients with cytopenic myelofibrosis more often present with just cytopenias, transfusion requirements, and the splenomegaly is less of an issue, but still can happen. So a couple things. So we know that anemia and the need for red blood cell transfusions are indicators of a poor prognosis and decreased survival. And as you can see on the left side, you'll see overall survival based on the degree of anemia. No anemia, the median survival is 8 years, and severe anemia, it's down to 2 years. And then if somebody is transfusion dependent versus transfusion independent, you do see a marked difference in their survival. Thrombocytopenia is also an indicator of poor prognosis. The DIPSS Plus acknowledges this thrombocytopenia as an independent risk factor for prognosis. And as you can see, based on this data, you have patients with really low platelet counts as compared to patients with platelets of greater than 100. You do see differences in their survival time. So what do we do about these? These patients are tricky to treat because I just told you ruxolitinib and fedratinib, the major side effects you get from these are anemia and thrombocytopenia. So what do we do for these patients? So there are current emerging treatments that will help with this. So for anemia, there's erythropoietin-stimulating agents, danazol, which is an androgen-like hormone. It's actually been used for a number of years, but can be very effective. There's luspatercept. Now, we know luspatercept is approved for myelodysplastic syndrome. It is being studied and not yet FDA approved for treatment of anemia and myelofibrosis. However, it is often used off-label in that setting, and even is mentioned in the NCCN guidelines as one of the possible treatment options. Momelotinib and pacritinib are both drugs that have an inhibit ACVR1. Inhibition of ACVR1 affects the iron metabolism pathway and has actually been shown to improve anemia. So what we know in these patients is they often have a high hepcidin level. With ACVR1 inhibition, you can actually lower that hepcidin. And by lowering the hepcidin, the anemia can get better. And then for thrombocytopenia, we're a little bit more limited. We just have pacritinib, and we will talk about these treatments. So let's first talk about pacritinib. Pacritinib has had sort of a very tumultuous time getting to the point of approval. So pacritinib was first studied with the PERSIST-1 and PERSIST-2 study. I'm going to not talk about the PERSIST-1 study in the interest of time, but the PERSIST-2 study is interesting because we did get a lot of information from this. So the PERSIST-2 study was a phase 3 trial, and what it compared was different doses of pacritinib along with best available therapy, which could also include JAK inhibitors. Now, there's a couple things to remember. Number one, a lot of these patients did have prior JAK inhibition therapy. Number two, these patients had moderate to severe thrombocytopenia, so their platelets had to be less than 100 at baseline in order to be enrolled. And so when you took these patients, they were being studied, and of course, as would be expected, the endpoints were spleen volume reduction of 35% or greater, and greater than 50% reduction total symptom score, meaning that you improved your spleen size and symptom burden. Now, this study was going along, and unfortunately, you have a very sick group of patients, as you can tell by looking at these inclusion criteria. So this study, unfortunately, was stopped because there was a higher rate of bleeding and major adverse cardiovascular events. So it was stopped, pretty abruptly, and put on a clinical hold. That clinical hold did not last. I think it lasted for about a year. And then CTI, fortunately, who had the drug at the time and still does, although now they've been bought by somebody else, CTI really pushed ahead, which is a good thing for patients. This data I'm going to show you about the PERSIST-2 study after the fact, much of it was actually after ad hoc analyses that were done after the fact. So when you look at symptom burden, we do know that patients who got pacritinib as compared to best available therapy did have improvement in their symptom burden. And it's important to note that if the best available therapy was ruxolitinib, this held true. And that's probably because if you get ruxolitinib, you can only usually use like 5 milligrams twice a day when their platelets are low. So you're really not getting an efficacious dose. And this on the right side, you just see the difference in all the symptoms as they decrease. But because knowing that this drug seemed to work fairly well, they did the PAC-203 study. Now, because of all these adverse events that happened with the PERSIST-2 study, the PAC-203 study actually had to be sort of started with dose finding. So this was a phase 2 dose finding study that was done. And this would include any patient, platelets were not part of the inclusion criteria, that had myelofibrosis, intermediate or high risk disease, and they had to either tried ruxolitinib and been intolerant of it for 28 days or resistant to ruxolitinib after greater than 3 months or had return of some of their symptoms or disease related problems. And so they were randomized 100 milligrams daily, twice a day, or 200 milligrams twice a day. And again, the primary endpoint was really to make sure that A, this was safe to give because of the adverse effects that happened with the PERSIST-2 study, and confirm what the appropriate dose was for that. Now, fortunately, there's two great things that came out of this study. I think number one, we knew that it reduced the spleen size. Now, this does seem to be the most efficacious when you look at the 200 milligrams twice daily dosing, as you can see by those waterfall plots on the top there. And then when we look at the total symptom score, that one was not as dependent on dose. And this is actually pretty consistent. You see similar findings with ruxolitinib. But 31% of patients with severe thrombocytopenia, I mean, their platelets were less than 50, had spleen volume reduction, which is pretty great for a disease that we know that spleen volume reduction can be very helpful. And the 200 milligrams twice a day, if we looked at TSS as a continuous variable, not just as plus or minus 50%, did show improvements as you got to higher levels of pactinib. Now, when we look at the adverse events associated with in the PAC-203, we did not see the same degree of these major cardiovascular events or bleeding events. And these patients were monitored extremely closely with multiple echoes and stuff like that. And in terms of the difference, we didn't really see substantial differences between these adverse events effects in the different dose ranges. Now, the other thing that kind of came out of this was that's important to remember is the platelets stayed stable. This will not make your platelets better. You can see a decrease in the platelets, especially initially. You'll see the triangle on that line, the plot on the left-hand side. They can decrease initially, and that is okay. So just A, they won't go up, and B, they may decrease initially, and that's okay, are two big things to remember about pacritinib. The other thing that came out of it was that they actually found that many patients had improvement in their anemia. And then retrospectively, they went and looked back and said, hey, we have this ACVR1 inhibition, which was one thing that momelotinib kind of touted, but they found that there was a biologic basis for this increase in their anemia. So how do we manage myelofibrosis-associated anemia? This is really one of the hardest things to do. And fortunately, we're coming up with more and more treatment options for the patients for this. So the biggest division in how we kind of start with the NCCN guidelines, and I think that persists, is that we look at the serum erythropoietin level. If it's greater than 500, they're likely not going to respond to erythropoietin-stimulating agents. So if it's less than 500, you can try them. But really, give them 12 weeks. If you don't start to really see a response, I would bag it. I don't think we see, the response in myelofibrosis to ESAs isn't fantastic. So there are some patients who will benefit, but I wouldn't try it for long periods of time just for the hope that it will work, because if it doesn't work, usually within about 12 weeks, it probably won't. Other options that can be used if the serum erythropoietin level is high or if erythropoietin stimulating agents don't work are things like danazol. Lenalidomide can be used, or thalidomide, which have both been potentially shown to help anemia. They're usually given with prednisone. And then luspatercept. Now, I will say in today's practice, a lot of people are probably using luspatercept over using lenalidomide or thalidomide. They've really kind of fallen out of favor, I think, because of some of their side effects. And if there's a response, again, you continue treatment. If no response, then you have to go back to the drawing board. So how does luspatercept work? Luspatercept is a drug, and it's an activin receptor. So basically, what happens is if the activin comes and it binds to the red cell membrane, it actually impairs red blood cell maturation so that the cell gets kind of stuck and won't proceed forward and become a nice, lovely red blood cell that goes in the peripheral blood. If you can bind that activin and hold it out so it doesn't actually go to the cell and inhibit the red cell maturation, the red cell can improve and become nice, healthy red cell, go out to the peripheral blood. And so the data that we have thus far, there was a phase 2 study. It had 4 different arms, which made it kind of confusing. And what you'll see with this is you'll see the different cohorts. So there were 2 patients either receiving Rux or not receiving Rux. And within that group, did they need transfusions or did they not need transfusions? And then what you can see is that patients who are achieving the endpoint, which is the reduction in red blood cell transfusions or improvement of the hemoglobin by greater than 1.5. And so the effect of ruxolitinib in patients who were was a little bit more pronounced, I think, than the patients who were not receiving ruxolitinib. And so they have gone on to further study. It's in a phase 3 study looking at luspatercept in that population. Nonetheless, people have actually started to use it. So finally, and hopefully I'm not talking too fast, finally, there's momelotinib. And this one actually just got approved last month, which was a real exciting thing because momelotinib has had some very nice results for patients who have anemia. This also has a fairly prolonged story of how it got approved. I won't go into all the details, but I think the important thing to know about momelotinib is this is a study that got it approved. Momelotinib versus danazol. When they went to the FDA and said, how are we going to show you that momelotinib works for approval? They said, well, what's the best? They really went on the approval based on the improvement in anemia. And so they said, what's the only treatment we really know that can help anemia and myelofibrosis? And danazol was chosen as the treatment arm. So momelotinib inhibits JAK1 and JAK2, which is similar to what the other JAK inhibitors do. But the other thing it does is it actually blocks ACVR1. And in doing so, as I said before, decreases hepcidin, which improves anemia. And so, you know, when it was initially looked at with regards to spleen size and symptom burden, the results were not quite as pronounced as one would hope. But then when you looked at it closer and you said, geez, people who had improvement in their anemia did really well. They really proceeded and pushed forward with this, which was a good thing. The study patients who went on Momentum previously treated with a JAK inhibitor, symptomatic, they had to have a hemoglobin of less than 10. And this study took patients whose platelets were could be as low as 25. Now, I'll point out that both ruxolitinib and fedratinib are FDA approved for patients whose platelets are greater than 50. Pacritinib for patients lower than 50. So this is sort of encroaching on that pacritinib space. There's momelotinib versus danazol, and they were allowed to cross over at week 24, which is when they did the primary endpoint assessment. And what they found is a couple of things. Number one, more patients who got momelotinib than had a symptom response as compared to those who got danazol, which is not unexpected because danazol really only helps anemia. Additionally, you would expect that the spleen volume reduction was much better in momelotinib as danazol because danazol is not designed to shrink the spleen. The big thing that people wanted to watch is the transfusion independence rate. And then that was found to be non-inferior in momelotinib versus danazol. So going back to that original question of how were these findings, again, it's probably not that important to remember what was a superior versus what was non-inferior. I think the take-home of momelotinib is not only do we get the benefits of JAK inhibition, which are shrinking the spleen and making you feel better, but you also may get some transfusion independence, which is a big plus to patients for not only reasons of quality of life, but actually is associated with survival benefits. The treatment treatment emergent adverse effects. Patients still could get thrombocytopenia, anemia, neutropenia. This is looking at any grade or grade 3. You also did see some diarrhea in patients. Now, one of the side effects that they were particularly interested in was peripheral neuropathy, as in some of the original momelotinib studies that seemed to be a problem. It did not appear to be a problem in this study. Now, when all of this came about and pacritinib started to look at their data and said, we improve anemia, they actually also showed that they do inhibit ACVR1 too. So when we look at these different drugs, all the different JAK inhibitors, I think the way that I always put them in my head is you have ruxolitinib and fedratinib. Both can cause anemia and thrombocytopenia and are both good for patients who have reasonable counts. Honestly, I think for patients who have anemia, you know, you have momelotinib and pacritinib. I think pacritinib is probably really good for the patients with super low platelets. Both of them can be used in anemia. And I think a lot of what's going to determine this is people's comfort and how their experience goes with the drug. Because I think that all, you know, when you look at pacritinib and momelotinib, there are a lot of similarities to the two. And I think they both can provide a really good benefit for patients who otherwise wouldn't have a benefit. But there are a lot of data out there trying to compare all these different small molecular aspects of it. And although it's interesting, I don't know that it necessarily is going to change how I practice. And this is looking at transfusion independence and pacritinib. So in conclusion, this patient was on ruxolitinib. He had erythropoietin added because his hemoglobin dropped. And 6 months later, anemia and thrombocytopenia worsened despite increasing doses of erythropoietin. So the dose of ruxolitinib is decreased to try to mitigate anemia. And unfortunately, when that happens, the spleen size grows and people feel worse. So then the patient was switched to pacritinib 200 milligrams twice daily, had an improvement in spleen size and the hemoglobin now went up. Now, in this patient, probably in today's day, and again, we haven't, I don't think, changed these slides since the approval of momelotinib 1 month ago, you could probably be reasonably using either the pacritinib or the momelotinib, especially if their platelets are greater than 25. And then finally, in the last couple minutes before we have questions, this is a patient who is currently on treatment. This is a patient who is 76, has fatigue, weight loss, abdominal fullness. He had splenomegaly. And his blood counts are, as you see there, white blood cell count of 9.5 with 3% blasts, a hemoglobin of 10.5 and platelets of 181. Bone marrow biopsy was cellular. He had a little bit of fibrosis and he had 5% blasts in his marrow. Cytogenetics were normal and he had a JAK2 mutation as well as an ASXL1. He was started on ruxolitinib, 10 milligrams twice daily, and initially noted some improvement in constitutional and symptoms and started to gain weight. But his spleen size reduction is not that great. It was only modest, so he didn't actually meet those criteria for endpoint. Now, I think one of the take-home messages here is patients who have these high-risk mutations are less likely to respond to ruxolitinib, and their duration of response is shorter. So what are we doing for these patients? How can we improve things? You know, as I pointed out, the ASXL1, some of these mutations are, again, decrease the duration of response as well as the likelihood of response in ruxolitinib. If you look at all players who get ruxolitinib, especially based on the comfort studies, the median time of response is 3 years. So ultimately, you are looking at a drug that has great efficacy, but it has its limitations. So one of the things that you're going to see coming up is, you know, this is a really complex pathway that works into making this disease grow and makes this disease bad. So you have a number of different areas, you know, like the PI3 kinase pathway. This is the JAK2, and this is the JAK-STAT signaling that is one of the big drivers of it. But as you can see, there's a number of other things here. There's PI3 kinase, there's BCL2, there's the MAPK pathway. So there's all these other pathways that we're trying to say, is there a way we can target these pathways to make the response more durable or better? And these are drugs that are being currently tested. I think right now, the add-on to Rux or post-Ruxolitinib approaches that are in clinical development are CPI 0160, and that is a BET inhibitor that's showing some really, really nice responses, not only as a way to help reduce or improve the response, like if somebody starts losing the response to Ruxolitinib, but upfront can maybe enhance the response and make it a more durable response. Navitoclax, the same thing. These are both in phase 3 studies. Imetelstat, this is a telomerase inhibitor. This is in a phase 3 study. Again, this one actually potentially may have a survival advantage. There's bomedemstat, which is an LSD1 inhibitor that's really been shown to have great data in essential thrombocythemia, but it's also being studied in the setting of myelofibrosis. KRT-232, this is an MDM2 inhibitor. That's currently in phase 3 studies. There's momelotinib, which actually we need to take off on clinical development because it's FDA approved. Selinexor, which also is actually now in phase 3 studies. And then there's a PIM kinase inhibitor as well. So there's a number of different things that we're studying to try to really improve our ability to treat these patients above and beyond JAK inhibitors. The most exciting thing was actually plenary session abstract at ASH last year. And this is a mutant, targeting the mutant calreticulin. So one thing about the calreticulin is that it actually, the mutated part of the protein exists outside of the cell, not internal to the cell. So it's a great target for immunotherapy. And so now they've developed an antibody that actually targets CALR. So you'll see that little blue thing outside of the cell with like the red tail. That's a mutant CALR. And then the antibody attaches it. And they've shown at least in preliminary lab work that this may be of benefit. Not something that's going to be in prime time any, you know, in the next few years, but definitely something that's very, very exciting. And this is the CALR monoclonal antibody. and just some of the surrogate endpoints that show that it may work. And this isn't a mouse, which we know is the best place to start doing research. So just to kind of summarize, when we think of treating myelofibrosis, we do want to always think about it from what are the clinical issues that we need to address. So with anemia, you know, I think using ESAs, danazol, corticosteroids, luspatercept. When we have symptomatic splenomegaly, things like ruxolitinib, fedratinib, pacritinib, and momelotinib. Constitutional symptoms is still all of the JAK inhibitors because they really do help improve constitutional symptoms and quality of life. If patients have extramedullary hematopoiesis, sometimes you can consider radiation therapy. And then, you know, as we go down, and these are things we didn't necessarily discuss in the presentation, the risk of thrombosis, accelerated blast phase, and improved survival. And I think these are all things that we're working on trying to make better. So what are the unmet needs and future outlooks? You know, right now we've really figured out how to harness our treatments against symptoms and spleen, et cetera. But really patients are saying, what's going to make me live longer? So that's something that we need to focus on. JAK inhibitors, what do we do when they quit working? And how do we make them last longer, be more effective? Anemia and thrombocytopenia, we have therapies now, which is fantastic, but we probably need more. And then again, what can we do to make these JAK inhibitors work better? So this is a hypothetical future approach. So you have anemia with and without thrombocytopenia and different approaches that you can take. Anemia, splenomegaly, and symptoms. And then when you look at splenomegaly and symptoms with and without thrombocytopenia. So there's a number of different things that we can look at in terms of how we approach these patients. All right. Well, thank you very much for your attention this morning. And hopefully you'll have at least a little bit more knowledge about myelofibrosis, and I didn't make it too overwhelming.
Thank you for your great presentation and your teachings and expertise.